Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Cosmos Magazine, Autumn 2017, Episode 2, something called Climate Watch in Earth Sciences, Enlightened Shelf Interests, Us Shelves, Forecasting Global Sea Level rises Tough. The blame lies with Antarctica, James Mitchell Crowe reports. Estimates of global sea level rises by 2100 have fluctuated wildly in recent decades, from more than 2 metres to as little as 31 centimetres. The rubbery figures have been a source of ammunition for climate change sceptics and the consternation for policymakers to turn undermining their ability to plan ahead. Most of the blame can be levelled at Antarctica, its 30 million cubic kilometre ice sheet holds 90% of the world's fresh water. If it all melted, the sea levels would rise 60 metres. By contrast, a melted Greenland ice sheet, the world's second largest, would contribute 6 metres. So 60 metres versus 6. Predicting the rate of ice melt in Greenland is relatively straightforward. Antarctic's melt is anything but. The stability of Antarctic's ice sheets depends on floating ice shelves, fringes. They act as plugs, halting the movement of ice sheets. It is the dynamics that the interaction that has been hard to fathom. The most recent IPCC report, published in 2013, estimates Antarctica ice would contribute just 4 centimetres to the global sea level rise by the end of the century, leading to an overall rise of 70 centimetres by the end of the century under business-as-usual emission scenarios. That estimate, according to Nick Gulrich, the Antarctic ice sheet modeller in Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand, was extremely conservative because the report's authors just didn't know enough about fast dynamics of ice sheets. The scientific understanding has moved on since then, confirming Antarctic will contribute way more than 4 centimetres by 2010. The latest research is converging on a figure more like half a metre, Gorich says. Researchers have discovered how unpredictable ice sheet dynamics are. Could be in 2002 when a 3,000, I'll just look at the levels, is 30 million, so that's a thousandth of it, 3,500 kilometre chunk of the Larsen B ice shelf disintegrated, located under the Antarctic Peninsula, the continent's most northerly and warmest point. It has appeared perfectly stable. While the melting of Larsen B didn't take any direct difference to sea levels, just the melting of an ice block won't raise the level of your drink. It was a canary in the coal mine. Before the Larsen B event, scientists thought the ice sheets moved very steadily fashion, says Matt Kim, who researches Antarctic's contribute to sea level rise at the University of Tasmania. Quote, "You could kick it as much as you like, and it didn't really do much. Now we have a completely different view." What led to the collapse of Larsen B was a rising summer temperature in the Antarctic Peninsula, with the mercury spending more time above zero in years beforehand. As a result, vast pools of meltwater formed on top of the thinning ice, fracturing it and pouring it into cracks and ultimately broke apart in the whole chunk. The summer surface melting is a well-understood process and is a dominant factor in Greenland's melt, making it highly predictable. Process can explain what happened in the northern tip of Antarctica, but it can't account for the changes seen in the rest of the southern continent, where temperatures particularly remain below freezing. Here, the peril seems to come from below. One hot spot in East Antarctica is rapidly thinning the ice shelf, fringing the large Totten Glacier. In a study published in the Science Advances in December 2016, a CSIRO-led team confirmed warm water from deep ocean is slipping up onto the Antarctic continental shelf and reaching the Totten via deep canyons in the sea floor. Quote, "If there's one thing ice hates, it's warm water. It's tremendously efficient at melting ice," King says. Warm water is not just a threat to the floating ice shelves. In West Antarctica, the ice sheet sits on bedrock, that is, below sea level, raising the risk warmer water could stream in and undercut the ice sheet. This ice warms, thins and cracks, yet another feedback mechanism might come into play, according to the modelling by Robert DiCono of the University of Massachusetts and David Portland at Pennsylvania State University. Each time a piece of ice shelf breaks off, the remaining ice cliffs will be taller. That's inherently unstable, says Tony Warby, who heads the Atlantic Climate and Ecosystem Cooperative Research Centre in Hobart. Sooner or later, the cliffs will crumble under their own weight. Understanding the process is just the beginning of the ice modeler's work. Predicting when and how rapidly they will occur to forecast how much sea level will rise is quite another. So far, the estimates of Antarctic contribution to sea level rise by 2100 remain highly variable, a key challenge to the lack of data to be fed into the models. Hugh's section of East Antarctica coastal zone remained effectively unmapped. We don't know where the bedrock is or where the warm water can flow. In 2019, Australian researchers will take delivery of a new icebreaker able to map the seafloor on Antarctica's fringe. The ship will carry an unmanned underwater vehicle capable of navigating under the ice shelves. Very quickly, we'll start to build a picture of what the seafloor looks around the continental shelf around Antarctica, King says. Within a decade, researchers should be more confident in their predictions. Assuming, King notes, there's not more unknown aspects of the ice sheet. We've been surprised before. A very fantastic pitch. A prismatic spring of Yellowstone part. This is a very beautiful picture. Now, listed, I don't know what that actually means. A list. Okay. Extremophiles, a biologist's best friend. It doesn't seem to matter how inhospitable the environment, there is an organism adapted to live there. Scientists have found life in every extreme environment you can imagine, from volcanic cauldrons to highly alkaline seas. These extremophiles are not just curiosities. They could show us how life might exist on other planets with more hostile conditions than Earth. Some have led to innovations in material science, pharmacology and energy generation. There were four organisms that live in conditions that would kill most other forms of life and learn what they could teach us. Okay, it's a list. Okay, number one, heat-seeking microbes. Heated by subterranean supervolcano and bubbling hot springs of Yellowstone can exceed 90 degrees Celsius, too hot for ordinary organisms. In 1969, while studying the extremophile microbes that do live in Yellowstone's hot springs and give them their colour, Thomas D. Brock and Hudson Freeze of Indiana University discovered the Thermus aquaticus. This microbe went on to underpin almost every genetics discovery ever made. The T. aquaticus contains a heat-tolerant DNA polymerizing enzyme. Once isolated, it became the cornerstone of polymerase action. PCR is how tiny DNA samples are amplified to analysis, crucial for everything from crime scene analysis to genome reading. This is one of the uses scientists have already or hope soon to develop by studying extreme organisms. So it means that you can it's a DNA enzyme. So it's a DNA making enzyme and it operates at high temperature. Two, frosty reception. When winter arrives in Alaska, the local wood floods freeze solid. Some 7 months later, when spring finally arrives, the thawed-out frogs hops away. Freezing once could kill most other vertebrates, their organs pierced by ice crystals. Yet, as autumn sets in, Alaska's wood frogs survive 2 weeks of a night-day freeze-thaw cycle before finally freezing solid. The frogs, like certain other freeze-tolerant fish and insects, produce chemicals to stop ice crystals forming. Researchers hope that by studying these species, they'll learn how to mimic this ability to store human organs or transplant. Currently, organs are destroyed by freezing. They can only be kept for a few hours in refrigeration. Conan the bacterium. Deinonychus radiatus can survive a blast of gamma radiation 3,000 times a lethal dose for humans. In 1999, the U.S. Department of Energy funded research to sequence the bacteria's genome in the hope of developing waste-consuming microbes to clean extremely contaminated nuclear sites. Surprisingly, D. radiosonosis DNA has proved to just as susceptible to radiation damage as regular E. coli. The bacterium sequence is a set of antioxidants to protect its proteins from radiation damage. These proteins can then rapidly repair the damaged DNA. Last year, researchers showed that a peptide based on these antioxidants protect mice from usually lethal doses of radiation, a promising first step towards developing an effective radiation recovery pill for humans. Okay, this is one of these water bears. I love water bears. They're just so creepy, eight-legged things. So that's a bacteria, a frog. So extremophiles normally refers to microbes. These are things. And multi-extremophiles. The microscopic tardigrade, or water bear, can survive heat, cold, desiccation, lack of oxygen, and radiation. The tiny animal has even been shown to survive a 10-day trip into space, prompting some to suggest it's the kind of creature that could live on Mars. Not so. To survive these conditions, the tardigrade puts itself into a form of non-reproductive suspended animation. Some extremophiles, however, really do seem equipped for life on the red planet. Subterranean microorganisms found on Earth's deepest mines and caves seem to have what it takes to survive below the surface of Mars. Studying Earth's extremophiles offer a possible glimpse to what alien life may look like and where to look for it. Okay, so there's four things I just want to talk about. Now, Technopharm, and this is talking about some sort of radar launch satellite. It's called Marco. Will deploy from the Atlas V rocket carrying the InSight 1 week after launch. Marco's first challenge is the independent spacecraft will be unfold two of its wings like solar panels and its flat pack communication systems. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Solar System. Space missions used to be so expensive only superpowers could afford them. No longer. Cathal O'Connell. Quote, any man who can hitch the length and breadth of the galaxy, rough it, slum it, struggle against terrible odds, win through, and still knows where his tail is clearly a man to be reckoned with, Douglas Adams. Exploring the solar system is absurdly expensive. Even a single mission such as NASA's $675 million InSight probe to Mars, scheduled to launch in May 2018, would eclipse the total science budgets of most nations. But with tiny hitchhiking satellites called CubeSats, there may be finally a way to explore planets on a shoestring. Tangling along on the InSight mission were two CubeSats, small boxy satellites the size of carry-on suitcases, built by NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. These Mars Cube 1, or Marco, probes will be the first Cube satellites to voyage to another planet. If they pull off their $30 million mission, peanuts compared to many previous interplanetary missions, Marco could lead to a shift in how we explore the solar system, even opening the door to small nations to stake a claim. Space travel has finally become economy class fare. CubeSats were originally designed as a training tool, so university students could design and build satellites in the timeline of a semester. The basic idea was to cram instrumentation into a standard template, a cube of 10 centimeter sides. Almost 20 more years on, and more than 500 CubeSats have been launched successfully into orbit, with another 600 launches planned in 2017 alone. CubeSats have turned into a great leveler of the modern space exploration, achievable within the budgets of schools, universities, and even crowdfunding campaigns. Second cubes to Galileo delivers the flexibility to make larger, sophisticated CubeSats, such as LightSail 1, which hoisted a 32-meter-square sail in 2015. But so far, no CubeSat has ever left low Earth orbit, which is within 160 kilometers of Earth. Marco's mission requires two CubeSats to fly by themselves across more than 200 million kilometers of deep space during their 6.5-month mission. To survive deep space, they'll need a serious upgrade to the standard model. Each Marco is a 6-unit cube stack, stuffed with two deployable solar panels, two antennas, and the radio size of a tennis ball. Each mini thruster using the same kind of propellant used in some fire extinguishers will help Marco make the course corrections during the journey. To survive the bombardment of cosmic rays and solar wind, they'll use robust radiation-resistant electronics. Marco's job is to receive data from the InSight lander during the so-called 7-minute terror as it punches through the Martian atmosphere on the way to becoming the first seismometer on Mars. During this critical period of atmospheric entry and landing, InSight can't communicate with Earth directly, so Marco will relay the data. While this job is not mission critical for InSight, it will be a perfect demonstration of the feasibility of CubeSats far from Earth's orbit. If successful, Marco could alter the way we explore the solar system. Generally, NASA envisions launching a swarm of CubeSats, each carrying a single instrument or performing a single task. Each becomes a low-cost, highly specialized probe rather than a jack-of-all multiple trades as with conventional space probes. Stephen Hobbs, a planetary scientist at the University of New South Wales, says sending a bunch of low-cost missions might end giving out more of a bang for a buck compared with the typical multi-ton probes, which are very difficult to build and that only superpowers could afford. Another possibility is to send sacrificial CubeSats into the solar system, its most hellish places such as the surface of Venus, the plumes of Europa, or inside the volcanoes of Io. At least a dozen or other deep CubeSat missions are in the works, even before Marco. The InSpike project could be the first CubeSat to escape Earth's orbit sometime in 2017. It will carry two instruments, a magnetometer and to measure magnetic field useful for probing solar wind in fine detail, and a simple camera so it can orient itself to the stars. In 2018, NASA will send its new Orion spacecraft to the moon. Oh, this hasn't happened. And back, with 13 CubeSats taking along for the ride. After the Orion capsule separation from the upper stage, CubeSats will be ejected to take a range of missions scheduling, searching for ice on the moon, studying low at how yeast deal with space radiation, scouting near Earth for asteroids, measuring space weather and more. Hitchhiking will be the new way to see the solar system, no talent required. So, what is it, 2018, we're almost told, NASA hasn't sent its new Orion mission. 17 minutes in. Viewpoint, when textbooks are proven wrong. Okay, we scientists can't help but celebrate. You would think, wouldn't you? It doesn't happen that way. Norman Swan is a doctor of the multi-award winning producer and broadcaster on health issues. He is a phenomenal person. I don't know how he does it, how he presents it. He must have a team of excellent writers. The spread of meningococcal subtypes is complex and poorly understood. The meningitis, so meninges, I think, is the skin of the sac that the brain is held in. So most organs are held in that sac, and that sac can come inflamed, I believe. It's every pediatrician's nightmare. A child arrives in an emergency department with a high fever, a rash whose spots won't go away when you press under a glass, who turns their head away from lights. A toddler, well, a few hours before, and from the parents' stories, things are going downhill fast. If you get the diagnosis wrong, the child could be dead within hours. The safest assumption is that meningitis causing bacteria are causing the patients through the patient's bloodstream, septicemia, and affecting the membranes, meninges around the brain. The imperative is to get the intravenous antibiotics into the child as soon as possible. isn't it now the new meningococcus is not a childhood one? I'll just have to see whether they say this. There are several types of bacteria that can be called meningitis, but one is the most common, is meningococcus. Meningococcus subtypes are identified by single letters A, B, C, and Y. What's been concerning health authorities is the increase of cases of meningococcus W, or MenW. In Britain, 8 years ago, MenW represented only 1%. Today, it's 25% and growing. In Australia, the number of cases, while small, is also growing. Such is the concern that the two states, Western Australia and New South Wales, have started offering immunisation to teenagers. Anxiety is amplified because ANW affects older age groups, and meningitis is generally a disease doctors expect to see only in children or young adults. So clinicians' antennas aren't up when someone older comes into the surgery sick. Meningitis also doesn't necessarily present as meningitis. It can cause infected joints, pneumonia, and dangerous conditions called epiglottis. I think that's on thyroid, or in your throat. A dangerous condition where the flap that seals the upper airway when we swallow becomes inflamed and swollen and may suddenly unexplicably block the airway completely. The death rate from MenW is 13% compared with 5% from other subtypes. In South America, mortality rate can be as high as 28%. The mystery why MW is spreading, one theory is it's a niche hypothesis. That meningococcus occupies an ecological niche like sparrows in the city. If someone comes along, knocks off all the sparrows, common miners take over the sparrows, rooks and crannies. With meningococci, there are vaccines that target various subtypes. In Australia, for example, every infant receives MenC vaccine in their first year of life. MenC is disease is now much rarer. So has MW just muscled in on the vacancy? It's possible. But there may be other factors operating. For instance, after ANC immunisation was introduced in Australia, for some reason MB also started to decline, whereas the niche hypothesis suggests it should have risen. The spread of meningococcal subtypes is complex, poorly understood, and not uniform around the world. The United States, there's a rise in NY, and when Y, and no one's quite sure why. In New Zealand, there's a nasty form of MB, and again, no one knows why. The annual Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca, with massive numbers of people from all over the way of congregate, mix and then go back home, in the past has been implicated in the MW spread. Given the mystery, the main strategy to control meningococcal disease is immunisation. The two most common age groups affected by bacteria are on the under-5s and the teenagers, many of whom will carry meningococci in their noses without coming down with the disease. Why some people are carriers while others fall sick is another puzzle. Probably the answer is a combination of good health and good genes. The MNC policy is to get, with the MNC policy to get in early with the vaccinated infants, the MW given to older age groups affected, and the need to good coverage quickly, countries like Britain and Australia have opted to focus on teenagers. Is there anything for the rest of us can do? Meningococcal disease is rare in wealthier nations, so panic or fear are not useful responses. Doctors need to be vigilant and make diagnosis as early as possible so that the person can be treated effectively, and families in close contacts can be protected with prophylactic antibiotics. Oh, okay, have antibiotics as you go. Andy Duff is a professional astrophysicist. Well, yes. If you get paid, you'd be a professional science communicator. He specializes in using supercomputers to understand how galaxies form. Dawn of the Living Dead. The pulse of a white dwarf has astrophysicists questioning what we thought we knew about the life of stars. So white dwarf is the corpse of a star. It's held in by its own... the inverse square law of the gravitational field, so once you pack it in, it stays packed. Well, let's read it. When the textbooks are proven wrong, we scientists can't help but celebrate. So let's raise a glass to the white dwarf. We've always dismissed these aged fellows as defunct relics of a sun-sized star. It's beautiful, sort of English, isn't it? Now one has surprised us. Instead of going off gently into that good night, it's zapping the universe with a spinning beam of radiation. For astrophysicists like me, it's like hearing a retired centenarian has entered the World Heavyweight Boxing Championships and punching with the best of them. This unexpected behaviour was reported in January issue of Nature Astronomy by David Buckley at the South African Astronomy Astronomical Observatory and its colleagues at the University of Warwick. The white dwarf AR Scorpii, so it must be close, is, and its larger companion, a red dwarf, are located 380 light years away, separated from each other by just 3 times the distance between the Earth and the Moon. So that's 1 million kilometres, because the Earth and the Moon is, the Earth's 400 It's a third of a million kilometres per second is the speed of light. And the sun is 53 million kilometres away, which means it takes 8 minutes to get here. Till now, if you have asked me to describe a typical life story of a white dwarf, my explanation would have gone like something like this. Fast forward the next 5 billion years to see the sun age before your very eyes. Beautiful English. He's got beautiful, beautiful English here, this guy. Its surface reddens and bloats, and fusion reactions relocate to the outer layers. Its shapely edges blur as its atmosphere drifts into space. Now known as the Red Giant, it engulfs Mercury and Venus, and most certainly Earth and possibly Mars. At the end of those 5 billion years, the sun's nuclear fusion furnace has used up its fuel. Absence is the outward pressure, and it collapses under gravity. The result is an Earth-sized object about 1/1,000,000th of its original size, which is why I think it's 1,300,000 times the sun's volume, so that's why it would be 1/1,000,000th its size. After 10 million years of fusion, the sun is gone. The remaining carbon atoms crush till they form a near-perfect lattice akin to a diamond. Each teaspoon is worth material equals a ton of mass. It's now a white dwarf. Although the star's surface continues to glow white and hot more than 100,000 Kelvin, it's effectively dead. Now, the only thing I have to say here, unfortunately, mate, you can't see it here. He's written Kelvin with a capital K. That actually is incorrect. It should be a lowercase k. The uppercase K means there's 100,000 of those people. It's effectively dead, slowly fading, leaving black dwarf. There's no more role to play in the evolution of the galaxy. Our Scorpio, however, is different. Rather than fading away, it has been acting more like a lighthouse, spinning on its axis every 2 minutes and emitting a light, tightly focused beam of radiation along its magnetic poles. Like a giant dynamo, the beam is powered by a magnetic field, 100,000,000 times that of Earth. It is emitting a regular rotating beam. Our Scorpio is behaving like a pulsar, albeit a slow one. The cosmic beacons usually spin with a period of seconds or milliseconds, I would say, rather than minutes, and were previously thought to be powered only by neutron stars. The inside of a star with a mass at least 3 times that of the sun, I think it's 4 times before it goes, even more dense than a white dwarf, a teaspoon of a neutron star weighs 1 billion times, it's 4 times for a neutron star and 4 for a and above for a black hole, and 3 to 4 for a neutron star. Okay. Even more unusually, the beams of the feisty A Scorpio tear across the face of a companion star, accelerating material to close the speed of light and causing it to shine measurably brighter. Just as our Scorpio acquired the superpowers of a neutron star is a mystery that has astrophysicists bemused. White dwarfs are not supposed to be able to do this. Only neutron stars were thought to be able to power pulsars seen in their thousands across the galaxy. Now we know it's different. This isn't the first time researchers have suggested white dwarfs might not just be silent senior citizens. In 2008, Japanese astrophysicist Yatsuki Terada and colleagues published an article in the publications of the Astronomical Society for Japan that showed a rapidly rotating white dwarf, i.e. Aquarius, which is pretty close, and is pulsating with X-rays. To change the textbook, it's great to have more than one exception to the rule, which white dwarfs ultimately lay claim to the crown of first pulsars heavyweight is less important the fact that something extraordinary as an Earth-sized diamond crystal can hold more surprises to astronomers. I think it's diamond, but you'd be lucky. I think there's diamond and oxygen and sort of carbon and oxygen and stuff like that. Laurie Zoloth is Professor of Medical Ethics and Humanities at Northwestern University of Chicago, and Philosopher's Corner, Street Fighting Mean, M-I-E-N, or what that is. The American Geophysical Union's annual meeting is usually a quiet affair, but not last December. Many of the attending scientists move from the meeting rooms to the streets of San Francisco to protest President-elect Donald Trump's plans to pull out of the Paris Climate Accords. Likewise, the start of the academic year in the US science departments is a low-key affair. Professors choose their new graduate students and quietly teach winter quarter classes, but not this year. Since January, scientists have been exchanging emails, petitions, and planning a march of science in Washington. I think this has gone nowhere. A prominent climate scientist, Michaela Mann, called for rebellion against Trump's assault on climate science. These are not ordinary times. The climate scientists are not the only ones protesting. NASA's astrophysicists are protesting plans cut to the budgets. Environmental research and civil engineers are protesting changes to the EPA. Nobel Prize winners are circulating a petition with thousands of signatures denouncing new travel restrictions. In February, an annual meeting of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, AAAS, the talk of formal panels, seminar papers over lunch in every corridor was about Donald Trump. Senior scientists and policymakers spoke about defending science, and the shell-shocked Washington science policy veterans told stories of encounters with Trump supporters who deny global temperature change or the need to regulate mercury in the waterways. A nearby square, one could see what had become a familiar sight, hundreds of white-coated protesters holding signs like Science, Trump's Alternative Facts, and Don't Die Because of an Infection, Didn't die because of infection, thank a scientist. Protesters' fears are not unfounded. During the transition period, Trump's staff sent a 5-page memo to the EPA with 74 items that included questions about who attended the UN Climate Summit in Paris and who was involved in developing social costs of carbon metrics. The man pointed to the head of the EPA, Scott Pruitt, who consistently sued the agency while Oklahoma's Attorney General. Trump has also met with the prominent anti-vaccination activists and appointed this a Surgeon General who seems not to believe in human evolution. Oh my God, Father. The United States is such a whack place. In an interview with the BCC, the head of the AAAS, that's the American Society for the Advancement of Science, which is really interesting that their society. It's partly because the previous statements of the presidents and his appointees on issues of climate change and vaccination for children, which have not been keeping with good science, he said. But mostly it had to do with the new administration's seeming willful ignorance about science. Very few appointments are filled by people who understand science. There are very few comments about the importance of science. There's no science advisors in the White House, and now we don't know whether there will be one. And the silence is beginning to sound ominous. One of these omens, we realise, in mid-February, scientists woke up to a new reality with an executive order halting entry of 7 largely Muslim countries. One by one, American university presidents had to defend their researchers in every field and wonder if they could continue their work without the foreign students and postdocs so central to American scientists. Since the Enlightenment, science has worked to position itself as part of, apart from the dictates of the church or state. In fact, causality, verification, falsifiability are supposed to be the only things that drive science. Let's read that. Causality, verification, falsifiability is the only things to drive science to deliver a method by which we understand how the world works. That's why societies fund science. But what is the essential bargain, if that essential bargain is threatened? What if alternative facts and ideological passions drive policy? If it's ethical for scientists to protest? Yes. Is it ethical? For there is a time when neutrality is not enough, and that when the basic premise of science as a search for verifiable truths is at stake. So now the streets defend the great institutions of American science. Okay. The incurable engineer. Finally, a nanotechnology is worthy of the name. Nanotechnology, this is by Alan Finkel. Nanotechnology, when American engineer Eric Dexter coined this futuristic term in 81, he had a mind of molecule-sized machines that would do useful tasks. The idea was to copy nature's own machine, muscle proteins that exert force, for instance, enzymes that carry out chemical reactions. But engineering at the nanometer scale is tough. We're talking about working with individual atoms, silicon atoms of 0.2 nanometers across, muscle protein filaments as little as 7 nanometers in diameter. For decades, we let human engineers off the hook, allowing the bevy of prosaic items from paints to plastics to claim the title of nanotechnology. To qualify, these products had to involve particles smaller than 100 nanometers and display novel properties. Finally, last year, a man-made machine claimed the title in the way of Drexler Imagine. It also made it into the top 10 list of Science Magazine's breakthroughs of the year. Delightfully, this nanomachine made by Oxford Nanopore Technologies mimics the nature to achieve the feat of reading the sequence of letters in DNA code and chemically base guanine, adenine, thymine, and cytosine. A machine the size of a mobile phone, and unlike traditional sequences, which are desktop size and require DNA to be pre-cut into short segments, it can handle DNA as it comes, double-stranded long threads. This pocket sequencer promises to make DNA sequencing cheaper and accessible. In fact, it's already been used to identify Ebola virus in a matter of hours and to read the sequence of soil microbes aboard the International Space Station. Here's a nutshell description of how the sequence works. The machine is a nanopore, a large single molecule pierced by hollow channels a couple of nanometers in diameter. If you embed the nanopore in an ultra-thin membrane bathed in ionic solution and apply a small voltage, a tiny current will flow. As an aside, a reason I am so tickled by this achievement that our brain cells also communicate via tiny flowing through pores and proteins called ion channels. I spent the major part of my working career designing and manufacturing sensitive amplifiers to measure these currents. The simple idea behind nanopore is that a strand of DNA is threaded through. It partly blocks the current flow. Since the degree of blockage depends on a particular DNA letter, the fluctuations in current reflect the sequence of the letters and strands and scissors through the nanopore. Sounds simple, but always the devil's in the detail. The nanopore has two modules. The first grabs the double-stranded DNA, cleaves away one of the strands, which then retraces the remaining single strand through a hole. It holds each base for 100 microseconds. Okay, so that's 10,000 a second, before allowing it to proceed, thereby giving the detection system time to make a measurement. The second component is the pore, shaped like a thin hourglass. It's the narrowest at 0.2 nanometers in diameter. This narrowing is the sensing region, where the electrical resistance changes can be each base we squeeze through. A complication is that neighbouring bases on the DNA strand particularly block the constrictions. Actually, this is restored by reading the DNA strand multiple times. Ingenious, but it took 25 years to master the devilish detail. The implausible idea of a nanopore sequence was conceived in 1989 by David Dreamer of the University of California at Santa Cruz, but it was way ahead of its time. Years later, I was delighted to learn that Dreamer and his colleagues, in their early experiments to detect resistance fluctuations, used a patch clamp amplifier made by my former company, Axion Instruments. From how does Oxford make nanopores? It programs bacteria to do the work. Now scientists here and elsewhere are trying to develop next-generation nanopores, which will be directly fabricated from silicon nitride and graphene molecules. If they succeed, it will truly be Eric Drexler's dream fulfilled.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.